Welcome to WRTI's Classical Stream, made possible by contributions from listeners like you. Learn more at WRTI.org.
Welcome to Crossover, Michael Tilson Thomas.
Well, it's lovely to be with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You have completed this massive, Herculean task of doing the Mahler, all the symphonies. Is this the final recording that you have made, the one with the eighths?
No, we're still working on some recordings of the songs that, of course, contributed so mightily to his vision, that were the source material so much for many of the symphonies, and some of that's still going on. And then I'm also working on a film about Mahler, which deals a lot with source material of things I've been investigating and very much off the beaten track in various parts of Europe.
You undertook this entire project at a very, very important time. Was that coincidental? This was after 9/11, wasn't it?
Well, of course, there was no knowing that such a tragedy would happen. We were just gearing up for the first performance, which led to the first recording of the Sixth Symphony, and that concert was supposed to take place on the 12th of September. And, of course, 9/11 this happened, and then there was a whole issue about, are we going forward with this or not? And there was a kind of great discussion in the whole community about what to do. And I think partially because of the nature of the Sixth Symphony being the most tragic, perhaps, and almost dealing with kind of confrontational level of grief, that we decided to go ahead. And that was the first performance, the launching of the whole series, actually.
Well, of course, again, one never knows in life how timing works, but this is a massive undertaking. I do remember when Leonard Bernstein had done a whole series of Mahler recordings, and I think he identified very deeply with the whole project. I wondered if you went through a kind of an emotional transforming experience with this. Like, Mahler's hard. It's very, very profound to work with. How do you feel about going through it?
Such is the nature of the music that I don't think you would be achieving anything were you not to go through some very great emotional reassessment as part of a process of learning the pieces again. I mean, of course, I've known these pieces for a long part of my life. I mean, I first imprinted on Mahler, really, or he imprinted on me, I should say, when I was 13 years old. I heard a movement of Das Lied von der Erde, sort of by chance, and I really wasn't the same person after that happened. And I had, of course, done lots of the symphonies over the years, but it's a different thing when you're doing all of them in some sort of a cycle, particularly because it's my view anyway that the symphonies really are essentially one piece. They're like a kind of lifelong logbook of Mahler's concerning his thoughts of relating his childhood experiences, which are very intensely represented in these symphonies, and then further thoughts that his experiences in the wide world gave him. But ultimately, particularly in the later pieces, very much coming back to the source material of the very first pieces, like Klagen der Lied and the Songs of the Wayfarer and so on.
Yes.
That kind of material very much comes back in the later pieces in, a very concentrated and simple form. Remarkable.
Well, I of course, have listened to and love Mahler for years. I'm a musician myself. And I just was listening to the Ace. I really, suddenly it occurred to me that, you know, some of the symphonies don't have choral, you know, or vocal, you know, parts, but it's almost like an opera in many cases. I mean, you wonder how did he define the symphony? Why would he have included the vocal part as opposed to just a symphonic presentation, you know, without any voice?
Well, of course, there are many symphonies that use voices, the Second Symphony, the Third Symphony, the Fourth Symphony, and then the Eighth Symphony in its entirety is a vocal piece. But and Das Lied von der Erde, of course, he called this a song symphony, he called it, actually.
Right, exactly.
So the idea of voice and orchestra is essential to Mahler's vision of what a symphony all about. In the Eighth Symphony, he sort of adopted as a kind of tour de force the idea of setting these two massive texts in a kind of demonstration of astonishing ability to write counterpoint in the very best sort of post-Handelian kind of manner.
Well, I was going to say it's kind of like an oratorio at some point.
The first movement especially, and then the second movement is, as you said, as close to an opera as he ever got, because he's really writing music for different characters that one encounters going up this mountain that proceeds from the kind of world of doubt and human frailty higher and higher up to a state of great certainty and blessedness. I mean, this is the last chapter of Goethe's second part of Faust.
Faust, yes.
But along the way, you meet these different characters, these different people who are in sort of a different stage of their spiritual advancement. And some of them are still in great moments of testing and torment, and others are more certain and resolved, and some even have a sort of sense of humor about the whole thing, some of them. And Mahler's amazing in setting this text in such a vivid and colorful way. And by contrast, you know, there is a piece, Scenes from Faust, that Schumann wrote, in which this same text was set.
Mm-hmm.
And Schumann, of course, wrote very beautiful music, but it all tends to be rather reverential, shall we say. By contrast, Mahler's music is filled with very sparkling, witty, ironic, even really parodistic elements, in which he sometimes has the music that goes with the text,
yes.
Sometimes it really goes against the text.
It, yes.
And he's, as usual, giving a picture of his worldview of life, which is basically crammed full of absolutely everything. And from the standpoint of the musicians, this is always the big problem, that they have to play the most beautifully, but at other times they have to play in really a grotesque sort of way, almost as if they're street musicians. And he expects all of these qualities to be part of their range as performers, which is why working on a cycle like this with an orchestra is really a way of kind of expanding everyone's conception of what music making may be.
Well, you've used a wonderful word. Grotesque is really what one feels. I mean, you'll be kind of enveloped in this marvelous, emotional, deep, passionate, climactic kind of thing. And then all of a sudden you will have these dissonances and the performance is very sharp and it's biting, and he plays around with you, basically.
Oh yes, he's a real trickster in many ways, and he delights in that. But of course, he always has a big message in mind. And the essential thing about Mahler, I believe, is that from his childhood, the vicissitudes of his experience in this little town he came from, which is now in the Czech Republic, and his experience of life in military parade grounds and in cabarets and in the synagogue and in the countryside and in this whole world of seeing all the various folk cultures that he was experiencing in this kind of hinterland of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at that point, that he was able to take all that in. He was able to take in the rather sad experience of his childhood with death of so many of his siblings and the situation that was very often violent between his parents, many other things. But at the same time, he was able to somehow see this within the larger sense of the wondrousness of life. And I think that's his big message, is that there is an underlying wonder to all of this, and one must never lose sight of that wonder. And if you're lucky, that you can, in the last moments of your life, come back to that grateful sense of wonder. That's, it seems to be, what his music is, by and large, about.
It kind of is what it is, and take it and then just revel in the beauty of the fact that life is like that, I suppose. I don't know. That's kind of, it's a romantic way of looking at things, I think, putting it into that context. But I think Mahler always presents a problem as a composer to many listeners, because, first of all, his works are so enormously vast, you know, just the length of them and the depth and breadth of them. And a lot of people are afraid to listen to Mahler. They're afraid to go to concerts where you're playing Mahler. Have you found that at all?
Oh, no, just quite the contrary.
Really?
Yes, I find that there's a enormously devoted public for hearing the music. And look, the length of Mahler's pieces, they're no longer than a reasonably lengthed movie. That's kind of, I think, how Mahler thought of his works. Of course, movies didn't exist when Mahler was writing these pieces. But the idea of writing a piece that's 90 minutes long, which presents a very intricate story, because his symphonies really are about something. There is a definite presentation of, in mood terms, of something that starts out in a very troubled, angry, or agitated sort of mood, mournful mood, and that gradually makes its way toward a state of great joy and blissfulness. Of course, this is the same terrain that we hear in Beethoven 9, but even in Mahler's case, there are even more excursions sort of explorations of unusual material that occurs along the way. And again, the music, which is really teetering back and forth between the highbrow and lowbrow mm-hmm. forms, and really kind of looking at the whole experience that people have in making music. I mean, why do people make music, I think, is an underlying question of a lot of his pieces. So something, for example, like in the Scherzo of the Seventh Symphony, which begins in a very, very stop-and-start kind of jerky, almost, you know, series of hiccups kind of thing, and which then settled into this very whispery, mysterious music, which sounds like perhaps spinning wheels or the kind of whisper of a hurdy-gurdy folk instrument. And then suddenly it takes you into the wildest waltzes, which almost sound at certain moments like circus music, and then into the most tender trios where little groups of oboes and English horns are playing this major minor music that sounds like the kind of most bittersweet folk song mm-hmm. that you would ever hear along the roadway someplace. And this whole stew pot of music is being cut back and forth between scene to scene, very much as a director would cut from scene to scene in a very intricately crafted film. So in all these ways, his music is so visionary. Even the shorter pieces, like this movement from the Seventh Symphony. But it's his desire, as he said, when he wrote a piece, he was trying to create something where the whole world was there. Each piece was a world.
Yes, it is. It is. There's no question about it. You experience that when you're listening. And then he can really just tear your guts out with some of the beauty of the melodies and the...
Absolutely. Well, of course, the symphony we're doing in Philadelphia very soon is the Second Symphony, the Resurrection Symphony, one
yes.
of his most popular symphonies, which is a huge epic that starts with the absolute stormiest music that there is and does make its way to a radiant, exalted mm-hmm. blessedness. But there's such colorful music. There's a lot of village music inside
yes.
of this particular symphony, a lot of references to the sort of thing that he would have heard as a boy. And I think the performances that the orchestra and I do of this music over the years has gone more and more in the direction of presenting the folkloric, tender kinds of colors, the different mordancies, you know, and I say sometimes ironic, sometimes wistful, sometimes whatever it may be, but we're very much focused on the kind of emotional colors of the piece and how this relate to the very, very vulnerable emotional state that Mahler still remembered from his childhood when he wrote this piece.
How has doing all this impacted on you? I mean, you really have to take this on as a project unto itself, you know. I mean, what happens? You've certainly put the San Francisco Symphony, of course, has always been a very wonderful symphony, but this has really, you know, drawn attention, I think, the phenomenal performances and the completion of this whole opus, I guess, this great work that you've done with Mahler. How has that impacted on you personally?
Well, it's been the public face of a very wonderful partnership. I mean, I have been the music director of the San Francisco Symphony now for 15 years, and this project came on board about 10 years ago, and we've won 11 Grammys.
Yes, you have.
Or maybe counting the technical ones, maybe even a few more than that, but something like that. And so it's been very wonderful that the partnership that I've been developing with the orchestra was recognized internationally in this kind of way. But I would say that this realm of communication, of the message of the music and perhaps the kind of communication that we have developed with one another, those of us who are making the music, has been a very, very, very beautiful thing. And I'm very happy to say that 15 years into my relationship with the orchestra, I feel that our communication is on the highest level that it's ever been. We are the most together. And that's partially, I think, to do with our having worked on this amazing project,
yes,
which deals so much with letting your feelings show, you know, not being disguised in your projection of the message of the music, and recognizing your own life in the music and just kind of sharing that experience with the audience. And I think that's been a very essential experience for all of us who have been lucky enough to work on it.
Well, certainly you have great players in the orchestra, and I think Mahler does call on their abilities as well. And when you allow them to do that, it's also a wonderful connection as a conductor with his orchestra. You also have pioneered a kind of movement in the sense that you have this SFS label. That's the symphony label, and you're doing your own recordings.
Yes.
And this, of course, is absolutely mandatory in the world of recording now, because it's very, very difficult for orchestras, obviously, to get their music recorded. When did this start?
It started shortly before the Mahler project began, and of course it's now extended also into videos and a lot of distribution of material online, and we really have explored to a great degree the possibilities that can exist within all these different worlds. I mean, something like the Keeping Score project, which the orchestra has undertaken, which is programs about the backstories of famous pieces of music and their composers, but also the backstories of those who are playing those pieces, really, in the people in the orchestra who are playing them. And that exists as a recording series. It exists as a internationally broadcasted television series. It exists as DVDs, which are based on those programs, but which include even more material. And, of course, it's a very, very elaborate website, very interactive website in which you can explore all the issues of the kinds of music, the origins of the music, the structure of the music, many things about that, on the web in your own time, in your own way. And also, it exists as a curriculum that is being put in place in many school systems around the country, in which history and other subjects can be given a more personal flavor by understanding some of the music that emerged from those eras.
So do you see this as a road that certain orchestras should, you know, try to follow?
Well, I don't really prescribe things like that. I mean, these particular projects are a reflection of my personality in many ways and things that I find interesting because of my background to do. And there are many very worthwhile things to do. I think you have to lead with your heart and do something because it really matters to you to do that. And this is what we're doing. But certainly, for me, the idea of the context of music being understood is essential. If classical music is perceived as a sort of abstraction, it of course will have an appeal, but if it's perceived as being really a matter of heart and soul, which it totally is, I'm very fond of saying, if you're alive, you have all the context you need for understanding anything in classical music, because classical music, perhaps more than any other music, deals with life as it actually is, in that pop musical forms, dance music forms, are very wonderful. They define a certain mood, one mood at a time, usually. And they have a particular groove, a particular swing, which is that mood. And we all love kind of basking in those moods. But classical music, by contrast, is dealing with many musical threads simultaneously and many different emotional threads. So it's not uncommon that a piece of classical music can have, for just even its main themes of its first movement, it can have sort of a happy theme, a questioning theme, an angry theme, a kind of giddy theme, and that these different themes are designed from the beginning to be as much in contrast as possible, and then the process of the piece is that they kind of play off one another, that kind of rubbing elbows with one another or colliding with one another, they assume a lot of different forms, different conclusions are arrived at. And this very much is the way we actually think. I mean, really, I don't know anyone who just says, oh, I'm happy. Now, we think I'm happy, but I'm a little bit resentful that such and such didn't happen perhaps sooner, a little bit apprehensive about what's going to happen next, and I can't help laughing when I think about how silly I was not to have seen this, that, or the other. You know, this is the stew pot of the way human beings really are.
Well, it's the range of emotions, but I think it's also a much larger format than, say, a pop tune. You know, music.
Oh, sure. I mean, so for example, yes, I mean, I totally admire a song like "Day in the Life" or the Beatles song or "Good Vibrations," mm-hmm. or "Surf's Up," even more the Beach Boys' great masterpiece. Yeah. But of course, these are masterpieces in a space of 3 minutes.
Right.
Something like the Beethoven Ninth Symphony is, it was just like kind of comparing a sketch with the Sistine Chapel or something like that.
That's
and part of the thing of experiencing classical music, you mentioned the length of the piece before, but that's kind of the point, you know, that if you go to visit the Sistine Chapel, the first time you go to see it, you'll say, oh, yes, well, there's God giving Adam life, and here's one of the prophetesses, and here's the part of the Last Judgment. You take in a few of the more postcard aspects of the work, but with repeated visits and repeated experience, you begin to see many, many more things in the structure of the work, the layout of the work, the emotional levels of the work.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's never happened for me that I was able to really take in the entire thing, but, you know, I still have a few more visits left. It was Michelangelo's purpose to create something which would not be perceived on first experience.
Well, I think what I was talking about is a singular viewpoint of a radio person, because we have comments that, you know, we are very proud that we play Mahler symphonies. Mm. Many, many, you know, classical formats now don't carry works of that length. So I think I was talking about that in a little different context than the music hall. But absolutely, I believe what you're saying, of course. And it's good to hear someone who is so positive about the future of classical music and of orchestras in general, because we're always, you know, exposed to the naysayers and the downside of what's happening in the music world. And of course, I'm sure you're aware of that as well. However, the San Francisco Symphony is soaring very high, and thanks to you, is really making a tremendous mark. And I thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to talk to us. And we could probably talk, as you say, there's the Sistine Chapel and then it's a glimpse. So we could talk for a long time, but thank you so much.
Well, I'm delighted to talk with you. And most of all, I'm looking forward to our music speaking for us in our upcoming performance, because I've loved performing in Philadelphia and loved working with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Nothing would give me greater pleasure than to share some of our San Francisco-style Mahler with the public there, and also with our colleagues in the orchestra. We really look forward to it.
And we look forward to your coming here. And thanks so much again, Maestro.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.